This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
For the first time ever, I saw an inflatable Jesus, Mary, and Joseph.
Oh, wow.
And on the second level of this person's house, they had an inflatable turd wearing a Santa hat. So wow. They were kind of like all over the place.
Very diversified. Yeah.
It sounds very Portland. That would really fly here.
Oh, awesome. So good.
I'm Alex Higley.
And I'm Lindsay Hunter.
And I'm a writer.
Writer, bud. With us today is Chelsea Beaker, who is the author of the novel Godshot, which was longlisted for the Center for Fiction's first novel prize, and the forthcoming story collection Heartbroke, coming in 2022. Her writing has been published by the Paris Review, Granta, The Cut, McSweeney's, Lit Hub, Electric Literature, and others. She is the recipient of a Rona Jaffe. Okay, I know I ask this all the time. Is it Rona Jaffe or Jaffe?
We're keeping this in.
It's Jaffe.
I mean, we should keep it in because I'm an idiot.
No, all right. Education.
She is the recipient of a Rona Jaffe Writers Award and a McDowell Colony Fellowship. Originally from California's Central Valley, she now lives in Portland, Oregon with her husband and two children where she teaches writing. Welcome, Chelsea.
Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Yay. We're so happy to have you. As always, we want to start off with the work part of the working life, the writing life. And Chelsea, I understand you've got a little something that you're going to read for us today.
I do. So I'm going to be reading from sort of this newer novel draft that I've been working on this year. So,
awesome.
Yes. So it's, you know, it's new. It's a little baby. I'm just going to read a few pages from that. And so this is kind of toward the beginning. I don't think I need to explain anything.
Great.
The problem was breastfeeding. See, I had been breastfeeding first big and then little, a commitment that had lasted nearly 5 solid years of hormonal witchcraft, minus the 9 months I was pregnant with little, of course, which was no vacation, but just a blip where I did not have a child's mouth pulling milk from me. A few months ago, though, little stopped having her nana. She was nearly 3. It was fine. Perfect timing, I thought, to adjust before preschool would start in the fall. It was a bit surprising. She had always been devoted to nursing in a sport-like fashion bordering on obsession. If we were home, she wanted my boobs out and available. She would nurse on one and grip the other like a stress ball. If we were in public, she would jam her sticky hand down my blouse and squirrel her way to my nipple, whispering, "Nana," in my ear, and then yelling, "Nana," if the nipple was too secure, thrashing her head, eyes blazing across the room, as if perhaps it had escaped under someone's table, jumped into another woman's purse. Often, I nursed her wherever we were, just so the yelling would stop, once pulling an entire dress up and bunching it around my neck, revealing thick cotton high-waisted underwear that I rationalized were more full coverage than most teenager shorts. But still, I caught a few furtive glances, even in our progressive feminist corner of the world. But little was happy with the arrangement, my level of discomfort in equal measure to her comfort, and she would curl up big baby style, her eyes looking up at me, saucers of love. We would both breathe sighs of relief. and I would settle my gaze on the middle distance, feeling less like a human than a talking snack machine, but at the same time more than a human too, like a super version of woman making actual edible food with my body to no one's applause. That ended when she became entranced by Big, as if she were just waking up to the fact that she had an older sister at all, and along with this realization came the fact that Big did not nurse. Big used a big girl cup, no lid. Little decided she needed one too. I took our picture in the mirror as she nursed for what I intuitively felt was the very last time and posted it to Instagram. Someone's done nursing. Hashtag bittersweet. Hashtag 5 years of breastfeeding. Hashtag slow childhood. Hashtag fed is best. You had to add the fed is best hashtag or off with your head. By then, I had learned to play motherhood mostly correctly and inclusively on social media, which turned out to be an adult game, like most other things. A barrage of comments had flooded in. Some were congratulatory, and some were stunned that I had still been nursing at Little's geriatric age. One person I didn't know who was hiding behind a cartoon of a cat for a profile picture said, "Well, you're a woman, not a cow." And I wasn't sure how to read it. Was it mean or funny? It didn't matter. I had thousands of followers and at this point didn't care a lot what they said to me. But there was one comment that stood out. Mama Candy 291 said, "Watch out for the weaning sads. Good luck. It totally fucked me up. You'll probably be fine, but if not, Godspeed." The weaning sads. I forgot it as soon as I read it and moved on. My breast stopped making milk without any objection. No clogged ducts, nothing. Every few days, I squeeze my nipples in the shower and slowly the spray of milk slowed to a droplet, then to a small yellow ooze. I had officially graduated. I had done it. I had made it through the baby stage. I bought myself a dress I'd been eyeing with a Victorian neckline that was totally breastfeeding unfriendly that I could finally wear in peace and forgot about it. But my body forgot nothing. The sads arrived a few weeks later and not just any. These sads were like a container settling over me, fuzzing out the normal view. They were alive and vibrational. Words like panic and rage come to mind, unreasonable worry, and do not forget the intrusive and vividly disastrous thoughts attached to that worry. But yet it remained hard to explain just what this feeling was. I could not articulate what went on in my mind to the husband because hearing myself explain it all out loud would only make it more real somehow. And I knew his reaction would be mild and diffusing. "Everything's fine, Clove," he would say. He believed in my ability to self-regulate too much. He had too much confidence in life working out. Silence would fall over us. I'd want him to say more, something helpful or even observational. "That sounds really hard." But no, he'd turn the conversation to an unrelated topic, trying perhaps to distract me, bless him, some tidbit he had learned from that Zac Efron show where he travels the world, taking his shirt off when possible, or a comment about life as he knew it. "Can you believe the Beastie Boys are like old now?" I'll stop there.
Oh, I love God. It. Thank you so much. I've seen so many tweets, I guess I should say, or comments of women sort of talking about the same thing, talking about this a bunch of weirdness happening after they've been done nursing. And it feels like a very specific thing, but it's not, right? Like it's, I guess my question is, does it feel revolutionary to you to write about this? How does it feel to write about this? Because it feels personal and specific but at the same time, like it's going to be music to a lot of women's ears.
Yeah. I mean, my personal experience with it was so mystifying. And it took me so long to figure out that after I'd weaned my daughter, I'd really had this kind of hormonal crash that you might compare to like a postpartum depression, anxiety situation. Mm-hmm. But I had absolutely no frame of reference for that. I mean, no one had ever mentioned that was a thing. She was like 2. So I was really out of the mindset of postpartum at all. I didn't even think about it. And it was like this whole year of trying to kind of scrape myself back up to a normal sense of life. And yeah, I mean, it was a lot. And yes, when you start Googling it, you find this whole community, usually on these mom boards, mm-hmm. like Mama Center and the mums boards of the UK, where women are talking about this. But, you know, I was just talking to a doula the other day and I asked her, do you get a lot of moms mentioning this? And is there education around it? And she kind of, you know, she said there wasn't a lot of education around it. She hoped there would be more soon, but right now there's not. It's certainly not in any handbook I was handed after I had a child.
So, yeah, it almost feels to me like the same way I feel when I read someone has written about having a period, or you know, just in general, when I see that in print, I feel like the angels are singing. Like, I feel like, oh my God, you know, like, yes, somebody's talking about this. Somebody's, you know, addressing this thing that we actually have so little, you know, like scientific research on, you know, and it feels like this is the way to open that door, right? Like that's why I came to the word revolutionary. It feels like, yes, okay, like somebody should be talking about this.
And you think about the predicament that is set up and the thing that you just read, the fact that a pretty innocuous comment could have so much running like electric through it, which it clearly did, like one pretty tame comment just kind of shows like, wow, this stuff really isn't talked about. And the fact that that could have like some kind of darkness behind it just shows that none of this is talked about it at all. I mean, I don't know. Yeah, definitely.
And there's a need for it. There's a need for it.
I was reading Ordinary Insanity by Sarah. I'm going to not say her last name right, so I don't even really want to try. It's like Menendek. Mm-hmm. But she writes all about postpartum anxiety. And I almost threw the book across the room when I read the part that says that more postpartum anxiety studies, like clinical studies, have been done on men than women.
Oh my God.
Oh my goodness.
I just felt so uncared for in that moment. I was like, fuck it all. What hope do I have to read about, you know, postpartum weaning disorders or something when not even this really basic thing is being clinically studied very much. So it was important for me to start to write about this in a super specific way.
And now's the right time, I feel like, because with the pandemic and so many moms continuing to work from home or having their jobs not bend to making their lives work, all this stuff is just like ratcheted up in people's lives and thinking, you know, even dads, of course, who are adjacent, but like, yeah, it's just, it really is. All right, it's enough. Let's hear all this. Let's get this out here.
Yeah. I can remember, you know, like being a nursing mom, it really becomes clear how much is on the mom, but it is treated like such a natural thing that we do that it's sort of like, no big deal. And then on top of that, Chelsea, I was going to ask you if you're still nursing Finn, but I don't need to ask you that. I was just going to say, you are a mom of two small children and you're writing you wrote this collection that's coming out in 2 years, and then you're writing a new thing, you know, like how do you get that done? What does your writing life look like?
Mm-hmm. That's such a good question. You know, I have this sensation that I'm never really doing anything. And then sometimes my husband or like a friend will be like, yeah, but didn't you just write this novel draft? Or like, didn't you just write a short story? Or didn't you just write a screenplay? Like all these things that I'm like, well, yeah, but my daily life just feels so inundated with just like cutting up snacks and and then cleaning the snacks off the floor over like in
Preach.
A loop. You know, I just buy food to throw it on the ground. And
that's what we do too. It's just floor, it's floor food.
It's floor food. It's organic floor food, which is even more depressing. But yeah, so it is getting done, and it's sort of mysterious how a lot of times it's just happening when they are asleep. So if I can get an early bedtime, that's a huge win. I might get 2 hours that night of writing time or... a nap time, which right now I'm really not getting much of that because my son has started revolting, or we're in some weird phase where I'm hoping the nap's not gone forever, but it's not been working out the last month. So that makes me panic a little bit because that daytime hour and a half was really important. And yeah, let's just hope that's not over. But It's just the sleepy. And then the weekends, I do a lot of weekend cramming where my husband, who has a more traditional like 9-to-5 situation, we'll switch. He'll just be the primary caregiver on Saturday and Sunday. And then I go into the basement and kind of do what I can. But you know, they still know they can access me. Like tonight I had to comb out this like softball size knot in my daughter's hair because I was the only one that could do it, you know. Mm-hmm. Like they know I'm here still, so it's just, you know, I'm still accessible, but it does get done. I think it's just this commitment that I'm going to accept whatever I can get, and I'm going to take it. Like I'll take the 30 minutes if that's all there is, and I'll just commit to doing it for just that short time. And and every day is looking a little different. I think the answer to this pandemically is similar to the answer would have been before, but it's just so heightened now. So every little bit, I'm like, okay, I'll take that 30 minutes. You know, it doesn't need to be this longer set of time.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing how parents can fill the time that they have, right? I feel like I've said that 400 times now, but it's just crazy how we know, okay, I think I've got this block of time coming up, right, and this is what I'm going to do. So help me.
Has your relationship to the people who read your work first changed at all during the pandemic? Lindsay and I were talking a little bit about that. I was just like, I feel like I've been leaning on some of these buddies, just first readers, a little bit more. And I remember listening to an interview with, I think, a friend of yours, Genevieve Hudson. And I think she mentioned that maybe you guys were each other's first readers. And I just kind of wanted to hear about what that means in your life to have people reading your work early on.
Yes. I like with a short story, I would send to Jen or maybe my friend Kira, like after that first draft, I would say like, here, take a look at this. But with a novel, I'm a little bit more protective of it when it's in this kind of baby phase where I almost fear getting too much feedback about it when it's still so wobbly. Like I want just to be working with it myself. So in that sense, there's not a lot of interaction with longer projects, but definitely with those shorter things. And what I actually, when I think about it, what I do a lot is I'll text Jen like a huge swath of text from like an excerpt and nice. I'll just bombard her with that, and she'll offer, just usually it's more that we're just encouraging each other, you know, like, oh yes, I love this part, or that's so funny, or whatever. But it feels like this nice back and forth that's short, it's accessible, and it's sort of like ringing this little bell, like, hey, we're still out here, we're still doing it, here's like, I did this today, this funny paragraph came out or something. More of that versus like a more traditional like reading and feedback structure, maybe. Nice. What about you two?
I was just gonna say that your relationship with Jen and maybe with T. Kira Madden, who wrote one of the best memoirs I've ever read in my life.
It's so good.
Reminds me of kind of like the key tenet of all the workshops that I do, which is when we talk about each other's work, we're going to talk about either what we see in it or what we love about it. Mm-hmm. Because I think all too often we sort of slag on it, and it's very objective also, right? Like it's very objective to think, well, this isn't my kind of thing, or I don't like how it ended, or blah, blah, blah. But it becomes almost more like, I'm going to help you build something because I'm going to tell you what I think is cool about it or what I learned from it or whatever. And it's amazing how much more helpful that kind of feedback is, in my opinion, than, well, this just doesn't work, or you need to, you know, beef this up, or who is this, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. I used to really prefer prescriptive feedback because I felt like maybe I was getting a more honest read. And even if I disagreed with it, at least I had information that I could, you know, recognize as being genuine, but that is no longer the case. I think I'm getting just softer and softer, and I want more, I just want more cheerleading. I want more like, hey bud, I love you, this is great, and let's keep going kind of thing.
Well, yeah, because like, I think intuitively we know, Like, we know if a scene needs something else, or we might know some of those things already. And what we're really needing, right, is that encouragement, is the fortification of what's going right in the piece. And there's space for figuring out the revision stuff later.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And the people close, the people close to us, you know, they know that we're going to keep trying. They know that this is not an end point, like you're saying. I mean, this is a checkpoint along the route here. So absolutely.
Yeah. I think about how many revisions I went through with my novel Godshot, and how different it was, and how maybe if I had sent it to someone too early and I had followed some, you know, advice that didn't really suit it, it may have put me off track. I don't know. Like, maybe I had to go through that seeking in a really solitary way for a while to know it well enough myself to hear feedback that was more critical.
What did your revising process look like with Godshot? You know, like, what was sort of prompting you through each revision?
Well, actually, my agent, who is really editorial and really hands-on and really wonderful. I felt like from the get-go, we were really on the same page. And so she was offering some like more pointed ideas about structure and things that, for me at least, like writing a novel, it's like, why would I know how to do that? Why would I know how to write a novel before ever writing a novel? It's such a specific skill. Like, and so it really felt like this learning process where she would be like, so, you know, if you drew out your structure on a piece of paper, that might be helpful. And so then I would do that. Or, you know, it was like her giving me these ideas for how to see it from more of a distance. Because really, I think for a long time in the writing of it, I felt too close to it. Or I just felt like I couldn't visualize the timeline or the structure in this larger way to make it a little more dynamic. And it was very long, you know. It was a lot of trimming and it was a lot of figuring out, you know, what does a story structure look like for this particular story and how can I kind of maximize what's here?
How much got trimmed from when the book sold to what was actually published, Chelsea?
Well, we did a big trim before we even sent it out. And then after I started working with Jonathan Lee at Catapult, he was like, you're going to need to get rid of like another 100 pages probably.
Oh, so, oh my goodness, wow. Gracious. Holy crap.
It really, and I was like, I knew that was definitely going to happen.
You knew it was going to be that much?
I did. I think, whoa. I had a feeling. it was too long. I mean, in the end, I don't know that we fully took out that much, like that exact amount, but quite a big chunk. And what's crazy is that the story didn't change at all. Like, that's just how much was in there that could be taken out. Mm-hmm. I think my process is very much like writing a lot, and then a lot of time goes into molding that and getting rid of a lot.
You know, I love that you're saying this, because I think a lot of people who, you know, felt like you did before you wrote the novel, which is sort of like, what, I don't have this skill, or I don't, what am I supposed to do? Someone tell me what to do. And it is really, for me, and it sounds like for you as well, it is a lot of like feeling around in the dark and just trying things. And then, you know, your editor at Catapult sounded like he saw what it could be and he believed in it. And that's what editors do, right? Like they are able to sort of work with you toward this thing that, you know, that works for everyone. But it really is something, I think it's something that I have to teach myself every single time, to write a novel, because I don't have a formula, and I don't want a formula. And so a lot of times I feel, you know, very scared and unsure. And every once in a while I feel like super punk rock, you know?
Yeah, I thought going into this new novel draft that I'm working on, I was like, well, you know, I have experience from this last time. And so there's things I'll avoid this time. You know, I'll streamline this process a bit. And no, like it's not going to be streamlined.
No,
I'm like, okay, yeah, I'm doing the same thing because that's just what I do. And right. That's fine, you know.
Because that's what's going to make it a Chelsea Beaker book, right?
Right, like, right.
I remember I kept a daily journal for when I wrote Eat Only When You're Hungry, my second novel, because I thought, like, I'm going to keep myself honest. I had like all the Goodreads reviews of Ugly Girls in my head. And I was like, I am going to be better. I'm going to, you know, I'm going to like remember my intentions on every page. And, you know, I'm going to write about, and it didn't matter. I never read my journal after I was done writing the book. I still have it somewhere, but it's just like, you know, it's always just going to be you doing you, right? Like it's, and eventually there'll be a hunk of rock that you can chisel into something.
Yeah. And each novel, I mean, this novel has already really presented me with specific, I don't want to call them challenges, I guess more like riddles that I'm going to be needing to solve, you know, that, that are new to me, that are going to be new skills that I'll adapt through doing this. So that's exciting too, right?
Absolutely. Do you approach short fiction the same way as a novel in early days with a project? Do you start with language or do you have some kind of sense of a character? What usually like gets you going into a piece?
Yeah, short fiction feels so voice driven. I mean, for me, it just feels like I'll hear a voice and then I'll let it start talking. But I don't know. Yeah, I feel like with a short story, there is something different about it where often it just presents itself to me. And sometimes it comes in like one really fast purge almost. Mm-hmm. And then I can work with that. And it feels contained in a nice way. You know, I wrote a lot of stories while I wrote my novel as a way to take a break from the novel. Mm-hmm. You know, by the end, I was like, well, it turns out that all of that evading the novel was another book. So cool. But yeah, I think short fiction for me can really feel so much fun and like such a vacation often. Yeah, I don't know. It just feels so voice heavy.
Can you talk a little bit more about what you mean by during breaks? I think sometimes people who maybe are starting out writing stories or trying to write a novel, it can be a little daunting to think about, okay, I'm stuck here with my novel. Does that mean it's okay to like devote space in my brain to this short project? Or so were you doing that, you know, when you were kind of reaching a stopping place in revision or when you were stumped, or was it something that you kind of had built into your novel writing process?
Yeah, it felt very much like, you know, I would sit down to write. And if it just felt, you know, that feeling where you're like, man, this isn't really clicking along today. Mm-hmm. This just, I'm not feeling that thing. And I could just recognize that and be like, well, then today's not the day. It's all right. You know? And it's not like I had anyone like on the other line desperate for my book. So I could take that time for, you know, it wasn't like a big deal. I would just, but it felt so good to just still be writing though. And often maybe the stories would be contained in the same world or the same kind of temperature as the novel. It was like another way in. But yeah, it was just more intuitive where I was like, I can accept that not every day I sit down to my novel is going to be that productive. So if I'm feeling one way to do something else, I'll just listen to that. And it just makes life a lot easier.
Definitely. I love that idea of being open to the work, speaking to each other. McGuane has this thing where he says when he's writing a story that he really knows is working, things from his everyday life and from just in his day-to-day that he's paying attention to seep into the story as a way that he knows that it's still alive to himself. And I think that's so much what you're talking about. Just the fact that, all right, we can keep this open. Here we go. Like, I'm still with it.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
Like when you, like you work the alarm that's going off into the dream you're having.
Yeah.
Right. Yes.
Chelsea, I remember us talking at one point that you keep a journal and you write like the meanest things in it. I would love to hear you talk about that.
Well, so I call it rage journaling and I love it. I think that, so it was sort of inspired by, I don't know if either one of you have heard of the work of Dr. John Sarno kind of in the 80s where he had a whole theory about, you know, physical pain is this more emotional manifestation of of anger. So unresolved anger finds a way to manifest in the body in back pain or headaches or whatever. And I was really interested in this and read a lot about it. And his cure for pain was to have this journaling practice where essentially you were writing like the most awful thoughts you could think of. We all have them, but we edit them very quickly. Like even in journaling, I think a lot of people journal. So they think, well, maybe that's the same thing. But if I'm journaling, I might have this really awful thought, but I'll edit it to have some sense of resolution or some deeper meaning right away. You know, like today was really hard, but this other, cause we're just conditioned to always be, if we don't look on the bright side, then we're not grateful for X, Y, or Z. And while that's really useful, like gratitude is so useful and necessary, there's also, I think, a place that is really productive in just getting out our most pure, irrational, angry thoughts somewhere. It does feel like a purging, and it does feel like a relief, and it is for no one. I mean, they're destroyed afterward. It's not like I would keep it. It's this very specific thing, and often leads me to really surprising things that I maybe am still holding on to that I maybe don't even like remember or realized I remembered, but then boom, there it is, you know? And I just started doing that, and I like it in another sense because it's like no other writing that I'm doing creatively. It's just its own purge, and it's just for me. And there's just some, even as a parent, right? So little is just ours.
Right. Oh my gosh.
Suddenly everything belongs to someone else, or multiple other little people. But not this. It's like, I can write like the most foul thought I had about, I don't even want to say about who. It'll be too
don't.
But you know, I can write it there and then it's fine. And then it's gone. I don't know. I find it to be healing. And I think a lot of other people based on his work, I mean, have reported that it's healing for them too. So
it just made me think about, I remember doing an event with T. Kira Madden where she said she was tired of people asking her if her memoir was cathartic for her because she felt that the catharsis had been done in therapy.
Yeah.
And it made me think like Chelsea is doing her catharsis elsewhere. And now she is able to clearly write using things from her life in her fiction rather than sort of writing something because you can't say it out loud. You can't say it to anyone and then turning it into a story, you know?
Right.
Do you feel like it helps you in that way? Is it more helpful like in your writing? Is it more helpful as a mother to have this kind of journal, or what do you think?
Yeah, I think it bleeds over into my writing where it's the experience of not feeling blocked. So like when I do get that time to sit down, I have more of a free channel into what I want to write. And I'm not wading through so much. And then on the other side, it's like in my more emotional life, I feel like when the pandemic started, it became very obvious to me and before that I was holding a lot of anger that I had for many years, probably forever, had told myself a story about it to make it okay or to give it, I don't know, some sort of deeper dramatic meaning in the grand scope of my life. It's like we're storytellers, so I don't know if you guys do this, but I think I'll tell myself these stories about things that happened to me in my childhood or whatever that make them a little more palatable, maybe even romantic, to have so much meaning that I can glean from them. But at the base of them is actually like a super unresolved basic anger of like, no, like that just wasn't okay. I'm really angry about it. And just exploring that without immediately rationalizing it, I've found to be necessary so that that anger doesn't come out in ways that I don't want it to now, you know, toward my children or toward my partner or whoever. I just felt that it was time to finally address that.
That's so interesting to me because I think one thing, when you can really tell that someone is all over whatever it is they're writing, you know, when something just feels like it's really connecting, I always think of the word control. You know, this writer is showing control. Just the fact that I completely trust this person to just leave me along here, whether, you know, despite any kind of stylistic thing or a barrier to entry for whatever reason, it's just you trust because of the control. And I feel like so much of what you're talking about is just you are learning to control all these different elements in your actual life better to help you do the same on the page. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, that is.
Because I don't have it.
Well, we're all working toward it.
It's funny, Alex, because your writing feels very controlled.
Maybe so. I think, and, you know, it feels so different from the inside. I feel like, you know, that's something Lindsay and I talk a lot about. She'll say something and I'll be like, are you out of your mind? This is amazing. Or this is like, what are you talking about? And the experience on the inside from creating all this stuff is so different, I feel like, than often what the reader is experiencing.
Yeah. Just look at Goodreads to figure that out.
There you go.
What is going on there?
Actually never look at it.
What is going on there?
I swore myself off of that.
Why? Why do they do it?
One week after my book came out, I was like, I'm actually going to have to see myself out of this arena.
It is ruinous. Okay.
It is. I'm not sure what's going on there. Maybe that's like the rage journal of society right there.
Oh, goodness. I think you're onto something.
Yeah, there it is.
You know what? I'm going to start doing my rage journaling there.
Oh, well, you're joining millions. You're joining millions doing the same.
Well, I'm going to give the book 5 stars and then I'm just going to talk about something else.
Yeah. Just give it the stars are all that really matters.
So. It is.
That's fine.
Well, it's confusing because sometimes I'll think this book is amazing and I'll go.
Oh, yeah.
And there are people that agree with me. So I'm like, okay, well then the people that hate my book must be right. But then I'll think this book is amazing and I'll go and Goodreads has given it 3.2 or whatever. And it's like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's disheartening.
It's not for us to know.
It isn't for us to know. That's so true. That's so true.
Chelsea, can you talk about titles real quick? Because both titles of your books are stunners and I want to know how you arrive at them or if they came from other people or are you the kind of person that starts with a title?
Well, I would say with short fiction, the titles feel so much easier and often present themselves like immediately or even first. And then with my novel and the short story collection title, I don't know, they felt harder, like especially Godshot, where for probably 3 years I was writing it, I had a different title and then a novel came out with that same title. So
say it. What is it?
It was
Eat Only When You're Hungry.
That's what it was. It's revealed. Well, for a long time, it wasn't even really a conscious title. I just put something at the top of the page that it was just Peach. I just called it Peach in my mind. The town is Peaches, California. It's like agricultural. I wasn't super attached to it, but yet when I saw this other novel come out called Peach, I felt suddenly very attached to it. And I was like, oh no, like now what? So I feel like Godshot was always in the mix though. And I have like these long lists that we were trying to figure, like find a new title and kind of mine it for other ideas. And I always liked a longer title myself, like these long sentence-like titles. But it just didn't feel like it fit this book. So at one point I thought maybe it was called Your Body Is Not a Lemon. And ultimately we just went another direction that packed a little more punch. But that one was more collaborative between like my agent, my editor, and me, I think, versus short fiction feels much easier. And then Heartbroke is just the title of one of the stories. And it felt really right for the collection once my editor suggested that one. So, so yeah, I owe it to other people, I think.
That's definitely true for me as well. And I was just going to say, I have felt like a dum-dum about it for a long time, but now I feel much better. My editor at FSG was the one who suggested Eat Only When You're Hungry. And,
what was it before?
It was nothing. It was nothing. Oh, okay. It was untitled. Yes. I was going to call it Greg.
I love both, actually.
Greg.
I fucking love the idea of a novel named Greg. Oh my God.
I know.
Well, I would have read anything you put out there and immediately adored it. Thank you. Can I pause to just say I'm such a Lindsay Hunter super fan?
Yeah, duh.
I am. Thank you. For so long.
I'm Venmoing you right now.
I just want to pause and let the world know. I mean, I've loved your work for a really long time, before the age of Instagram and before stalking you online. And, you know, have always felt really connected to it. And then Instagram gave me this, like, I felt like I could know you a little bit in this funny squares way. And I just want everyone to know that I was struggling so much with Finn, my son, my youngest child's sleep. And Lindsay mailed me physically in the mail a sleep guide book. So it was, I felt like that was like my real coming of age in that moment. That was so special. It was so wonderful. So
my favorite thing is to be there for other moms. I cannot get enough of it. So I am so glad that helped you.
Well, you're amazing. So thank you. I was like, how can I weave this anecdote into this podcast? Because it really feels like it needs to be in there. I also wanted to tell both of you that I'm also an Aries. So we have Aries on the line.
No wonder we're vibing so well.
We're vibing. So.
This is the new show.
This is the show. Yeah, actually, this is the final form.
This is my audition.
Yay, you're in. I mean, Aries are the best, so... We all know it.
We know it.
Chelsea, I almost wore my gold dress.
Oh my goodness.
But even though none of us can see each other, I felt like I should, but I just couldn't get out of my sweatshirt.
Lindsay, you wore that at a reading that we did together when you were very pregnant with Judith. And I have an amazing picture of us together with you in that dress.
Oh my gosh, Alex, that is a different gold item that I have.
Are you serious?
Yes.
Oh my gosh. It is gold and sparkly though, right? Am I crazy?
Oh no, you're not crazy. Okay. No, you're not crazy at all. No, it's a different gold item. And I actually ask for gold leggings for Christmas this year. So we'll see.
I love it.
Yes, in honor of Chelsea and her beautiful book, Godshot, which everybody should buy from your local independent bookstore.
Yeah. Or our bookshop affiliate page.
Can you pre-order Heartbroke?
I don't think so. Probably this summer.
As soon as you can, we will let people know. And you can pre-order that from your local independent bookstore or bookshop. And then Chelsea, tell us what the novel, we got a little glimpse of it. What are the depths that you're plumbing right now? That sounded gross, but you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I like it. I want to write a book about motherhood that is, I think what I've realized, you know, 6 years into this gig, my daughter is six, is that we have in our minds that there's going to be this baby phase that is somehow like there's a beginning and end to it. And what I've learned is that actually it never ends. Like there's always something, there's always this learning curve. There's always a challenge. There's always a sleep issue, right? Uh-huh. Even at six, that doesn't really stop. And I wanted to look at, you know, the postpartum weaning thing, that hormonal story, because I think in so many books about motherhood I read, it's almost like there's a gap where we see maybe the early baby phase is characterized, or there's like the mother that's arrived already and her kids are like 12. You know? Mm-hmm. but I am craving more of this, like this in the trenches when they're like 2.5 or 3, you know? And also exploring like being the mom of siblings and what that's like, because that has been in my life another mysterious thing to navigate. I grew up kind of an only child situation. So having these sibling relationships and navigating the parsing of one's attention and energy is interesting to me. And, and so there's that, but then also, you know, thinking so much about how having children, it just does trigger or bring to the surface, like we were talking about earlier, maybe anger from one's own childhood or memories and trauma. And so the book is also about the navigation of facing some trauma, which is hard actually to write on the page. It's like, how do I make maybe a childhood trauma that happened to this woman dynamic on the page in real time, mm-hmm. is the challenge of this book. I think for me, it's like she's confronted now through this sort of hormonal trigger to go into like this different headspace where she is suddenly remembering her childhood in this really vivid way that feels mm-hmm. so intense and so real to her in the moment. But yet on the surface, she's, you know, in yoga class, she's like picking a kid up from school. She's functioning as this human in the world that seems very high functional, but much of the novel's motion is happening under those waters. So I don't know. It's about that. It's about domestic violence. It's, I'm really selling it right now. I'm like, it's
no,
so
you are.
Happy.
It,
it's
like it sounds amazing. Like my kind of book.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, but it's just, these are the things that don't stop once you become a parent. Like right. we're not, there's no end to the processing of things. The things still come up. We're still people. It's like identity. You're a parent, and then also I'm a writer, but you know, I'm mm-hmm. a parent, but also
yep.
I need to go to therapy yep. and I haven't been able to since March. So you guys are now my therapist. Thank
hey,
you.
We get it.
I go to therapy online. So
yeah, there same, you go.
I know.
Same.
I know. I'm in between therapists right now. It's a real problem. I need to, I've been meditating. I was like, I'll just meditate and then that'll be it. But I'm thinking the clock.
It's not nothing.
On.
It's not nothing.
It's not nothing. No, it's like really powerful. Actually, it's great. But I do. I kind of am in a place where I'm like, maybe I could get another voice in the room with some of this stuff.
I was thinking Alex and I should do a special episode where we list all the things that we do. And maybe this, I'm speaking for both of us, Alex. I haven't told him this yet.
No,
where
you.
We just list all the things that we do in our lives to not be to not descend into a depression.
Oh God.
Let's talk about some right now.
Oh my God.
It's like, I got to exercise all the
yes,
time.
Yeah.
I gotta
yeah,
get outside.
You're on the Peloton bike.
Oh yeah. Come on.
Tell me about that.
Swaggerly on Peloton, y'all, if you're on the Peloton. come.
It looks
come
so
find me.
Fun.
It's it really fun. Great. It's really fun. And I was the first one to make fun of it before we got one. And, you know, like I've cried on the Peloton.
Oh,
I laugh a lot on the Peloton. I dance on the Peloton. It has been.
Is the seat comfortable?
Okay.
Ooh, good question.
My vagina hurt for.
Okay. Yeah.
Like I would say like a week to 10 days.
Okay.
And they sell, but then you get used to it. And I don't know how, does that mean I have calluses? I don't know.
No,
I don't,
it's a callus
just
situation.
It's
calluses.
It's not,
yeah.
It doesn't seem calloused. That'll be on our Patreon, Alex. Let's put that on
yeah.
the Patreon.
Well, that's,
we explore that further.
You said the $20 price point, right?
No, at least 25.
25.
But no, you do get used to it. And I don't know why. Maybe you like learn how to sit, but they do
yeah.
sell shorts that have padding in them. So if you're,
ooh,
they do get you, they get you out of the saddle a lot. So.
Merch. They got that merch.
You have that merch. Oh, and it's expensive. But no, I love that. Yeah. So, you know, there's like things that we all do to, cause we know if we don't do them, we're going to go to the bad place.
It's not reading for me. I have been struggling to read more than like a page at a time. And there's so many things that I want to be reading, but I just, writing has, I've been able to write during this period, but yeah, the mm-hmm. reading has been tough. I don't know.
Yeah. I've actually been like with the physical movement, I feel like I will now prioritize like a 2-mile walk over like an hour of writing. Cause I just have to be like outside. I mean, it's like a desperate feeling. So yeah, that movement is very key. I see the difference if I don't get to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yep. My final question for you is, do your kids believe in Santa Claus?
Oh my God.
Okay. So
both of you, please answer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah, so it's funny because at first, like when Harper was little, I thought, what am I going to like do about this? Is this just, am I going to say that it's real? What's the deal? And I thought, I'll just approach it as if Santa is the character in a story. We'll just read a story. Santa is the character. We believe in Santa as if we believe in any other character in our imaginations. You know, I'm not going to get tactile with it. I'm not going to be like, a man's coming in tonight. And it's gonna, you know, I'm just going to let her kind of take it where she wants.
Okay.
And it's interesting because she fully believes in Santa. I've never said it. I mean, she's just picking it up from wherever. And I think there's the desire to believe in it. It feels very evident in her, but she's at the age now where she started asking me like rapid fire questions about what I believe in. Like she'll ask me about religion. She'll ask me about Santa. And I always just kind of say like, you know, I don't know. The beauty is the mystery. And if you believe it in your heart, then that's wonderful. And I'll do this like long winding explanation when she probably just really wants like a yes or a no, but
I just leave
the door open.
Yeah. I have a friend who told me that he didn't tell his kids about Santa Claus because he didn't want Santa to get credit for the presents he got them.
Right.
And that was before I had kids. So I was like, okay, Grinch. But now that I have kids and I'm putting in all this time and money.
Yes.
Only for my kids to be like, yay, Santa. I'm like, what have I done? And my 7-year-old, my almost 8-year-old Parker, he's getting close to just like, he has said like, I think it's you, Mom. I think it's you. And I'll say the same thing. Like, well, I don't know, you know, like, da, 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 da. And I start thinking to myself, like, why did I do this? Now I have to tell him like, I've been insane for the past 8 years and let you believe this crazy thing. Because for me, like the magic is so important, right? Like you're saying, like the mystery. But I do think he just wants me to level with him, you know, and he sees the boxes arrive. And I'm like, oh, well, Santa needed our help this year. He needed to just ship it to us. And he's like, you know, it works on like my 4-year-old and my 2-year-old who has no idea what Santa is, but it's just, I feel so silly.
My daughter recently was like, well, Mom, we literally saw Santa last year at Christmas Mountain. Don't you remember? Like, cause we took a picture with Santa. We got our tree. And I was like, oh, well, sure. Yeah, I remember. Like, so I'm seeing the way that she took that in as really literal, like that we visited him. So how could you not believe? So.
And you did.
Yeah. What about you, Alec?
We're very Grinch focused right now as far as like the 2018 feature film, The Grinch, that they just pulled off Netflix, which ruined a couple of days for us.
Oh, no.
But because of the pandemic, you know, there's no other kids in our lives except, you know, on the telephone. It's not a telephone, the cell phone. And so we can just like sidestep entire realities and there's no Santa now. It's just like Grinch, the Grinch like hood that she wears when she gets out of the shower and runs around and like, you know, just Grinch life is it.
I think
that's the way to go.
Yeah.
There never was a Santa. There will never be a Santa.
There's no Santa, just Grinch.
Like last year I got my son, he loved Raina Telgmeier books and I got him a signed copy of one of her books. And I was like, this is from Santa, you know? Anyway. Well, thank you so much, Chelsea.
Thank you.
This was so fun. Thank you both so much. This was just the highlight of my week.
Where can people go to find out more about you?
I have a website. It's a fledgling little website, chelseabeaker.com.
Awesome.
Any hot tips for WordPress? I'll take them.
We need them too. We were just talking about that.
Yeah, pass those along to us.
It's not really in my wheelhouse to know how to work those web pages, but I'm trying.
I have a Tumblr, so I mean, don't ask me.
Tumblr is vintage. I like it.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And we look forward to everything that's coming.
Absolutely.
Likewise. Have a good night.
You too.
Bye.
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 I think that's the first person we've had on who has listened to the show because it's been out. And that was really exciting. It kind of felt like Chelsea knew the vibe coming in. And that was really cool.
Yeah, it was I don't know. I think I geek out on stuff like that, talking to someone about how they work, what mm-hmm. they're working on, the struggles.
She was totally game. She was totally game to just tell us. So mm-hmm. that made it so fun.
How's your week been? Have you gotten any work done?
I have. Yeah, I'm still plugging away on this novel. And yeah, I have been getting work done. But it's, it's baby steps. It's What About Bob? What about you?
I get mad when you say baby steps and people don't know that it's.
That's all I think about. Dr. Leo Marvin all day in my head. Just like, oh my God. That movie, Siggy jumping on the bed, kind of swearing, was like a religious experience for me. With my big bowl of vanilla ice cream.
Oh man, I love to hear about people's childhood go-to snacks.
Sure, Hershey syrup, vanilla ice cream, Cap'n Crunch on top sometimes.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
I have a friend who used to wax poetic about eating Wheat Thins and Dr. Pepper.
What the fuck?
That was like his thing. I don't know. We did weird things when I was a kid. We used to like dip our graham crackers in water.
Okay.
We would put butter on our graham crackers.
I can get down on that.
Yeah, it's good. I do it to this day. I can remember putting like old hardened frosting on a saltine.
Okay, I'm also there for that. Did you microwave tortillas with butter and just roll them up?
We would put butter and sugar on the tortillas and roll them up and eat them.
Mm-hmm. Yep, cinnamon sugar for us. But yeah, same thing. Yeah.
We would microwave string cheese on a plate until it was like fried to the plate and then peel it off and eat it.
That is a new one for me.
We would microwave chocolate chips.
Okay, yes. And then you just had the goop or what?
Yeah, we would just we just wanted the melty chocolate. Probably ate it with our fingers.
Oh my God.
Yeah. We, cream cheese toast.
Yep, that makes sense.
It's a big one for me. Like it had to be like dark toast. And then the cream cheese. Cream cheese was huge for me as a kid. Thankfully, I have passed that down onto my children.
It just comes up. You just mentioned cream cheese. I feel like that is just cream cheese just comes up. That is a thing that you say. I know it's a part of your life.
There's like something there that if I like really look closely at, it's going to unlock a secret to my past that I probably don't want to know.
Mm. I think you know.
moving on. I got work done.
Yeah,
I got work done. Just not my full 3 days because my middle child didn't have school on Friday and my oldest had screen free day after 11, which I thought was great that the school was doing because it's just too much. I didn't really get the time, but next week is another week, and I did what I could.
Definitely. Yes, we definitely did what we could. We're still, this holiday season is not a holiday season and it's just so rapidly passing. We're not religious. I'm not religious. And so we're not marking it in that way, but just the normal like flow of the holidays, I feel like is gone this year. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of, I think, in my head, I haven't said this, but I think I feel this is just my holiday is 2021. I am like, okay, I need to flip the page on this year. I think I'm just ready for a new thing and all energy is focused there forward.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think we've been like doing our best, like, trying to go see, like we went and drove through Christmas light displays and, trying to find things we can do that are safe with the kids. It really does feel like, okay, let's just get there. Let's just get through this.
Definitely.
Get to the next thing.
Definitely. Today was the first day that Britt and I had been out in public in a store together since March. And that was a totally alarming experience. I'm obviously out in public for my job all the time. And that has, that feels one way, but being in public in a store with my wife and I hadn't felt it as a customer, like in, you know, like in a retail situation with her and seeing people acting as people will act without any way to address the situation responsibly felt terrible. And
yeah,
I don't know. It just, it's like, I don't know. I guess I'm still kind of, it's still hitting me every day what's happening. It's just mm-hmm. like, oh, okay, here it is.
Yeah, it's rough. It's, you know, you just wish that we could have all united as one against it. And, and we just couldn't meet the moment. And, so that's rough. That's rough. I had a cashier, I went grocery shopping and there was a cashier and she had a mask on, but her nose was out.
Oh my God. I was just going to talk about this.
She was coughing.
Oh Jesus.
And I was like, I'm just going to give her the benefit of the doubt. And I know this is a hard job and everything, but I was just like, what in the world?
Why is there not a commercial on every 4 minutes on all the platforms that just put the goddamn mask over your nose?
I know.
Like, what is it with people and their noses? Just hide them.
I mean, I saw a really cool graphic that I think the city of Chicago put together, and it was inside the elevator at the library.
Okay.
And it was like, this is wrong. This is wrong. This is wrong. Like, this is what it's supposed to look like. Because, you know, people put it so that it's like not over their chin, or they put it below their nose, or they, you know, have it hanging off their ear or whatever.
Oh, it's hanging.
Yeah. And it's just, you know, I don't know. I think masks are a good thing and we should probably keep doing them even after the vaccines come.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had norovirus from my kids.
Whoa.
Like, way too many times. I would like to stop getting norovirus. Okay. Like I'm tired of that. So
yeah, I don't know. Anyway. I can't imagine so many things now, like a plane, a baseball game, mm-hmm. all these things. It seems like, I don't know. It's just whatever. I don't know how we got here, but
I went to so many live music shows in my 20s. In my late teens and my 20s that I got so sick of it. And now I'm desperate to go see live music.
Yeah.
I just want to go see someone.
Live music would be good. I just want to go to the bar and have 3 beers with a good friend and mm-hmm. eat lunch and leave. That's mm-hmm. all I want to do. I just want to eat lunch and leave. And
just like a delicious margarita.
Yes, sure. Margarita. Absolutely. I want to go
loud music.
Yeah, go to Women and Children first, go to Hop Leaf after, like, come on.
I know, like, see a friend, I know. And these are things, like, pre-pandemic, you know.
No, I didn't do these things pre-pandemic.
No,
No,
but now I'm like, oh, if only.
Oh, God.
Do you want to read anything?
I have nothing, Lindsay.
Alex?
I'm sorry. Do you have anything?
I always have something.
Is it about cream cheese?
Oh my gosh. No, I don't think there's any cream cheese in it.
You're not positive though?
I'm not. I mean, there just could be. After this, I should control F for cream cheese in my manuscript. Cause I bet it's
gonna
in there.
Be 17.
It's definitely in Eat Only When You're Hungry.
17.
You know how when you're editing and you're like, wow, I use the word, you know, suddenly so many times, I am so embarrassed. It's going to be my suddenly is going to be cream cheese.
My version of that is the word fess. I had that a million times in the book I'm working on. Like, instead of saying confess, I kept saying fess. And it's like, you are an asshole, Alex. Shut up.
I know. There's just those tics. They're so embarrassing. And they're so telling.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man. Stupid. Somebody tweeted, writers, please learn how to write an M dash.
Yes.
And I almost burned my laptop because I'm looking right now and I've my M dashes are just a mess.
Do you get John Lennon's newsletter that he sends out?
No.
The one that he sent out today was about this very topic and it was
excellent.
I'm gonna forward it to you.
I used to know how to do it, but then like it's different in every program. Like when you write in Word, you do an M dash this way. When you write in Google Docs, it's this way. I mean, was that the oldest thing I've ever sent in my life?
We can try for older.
I was just going to read, because I was talking last week about like writing as a collage and how I was wanting to look at this crime from, you know, like a bunch of different viewpoints and perspectives and, you know, even down to like what I'm about to read, which is when this family first buys the house and it's from the perspective of the realtor. And I don't think you'll ever see the realtor again.
Cool.
So it's sort of like this like stranger's viewpoint of these people.
Nice.
It's pretty short. And that's the other thing is like, I never do this, but I'm not holding myself to any sort of like chapter length. Like if it's a 500 word chapter, then that's fine.
I love that.
So that's basically what I think this is. All right. The house wasn't brand spanking new when they moved in, but it was as close as. An older couple had purchased it 5 years prior, had it built from the ground up, and then they died within 3 months of each other, and the house went up for sale, and the Newsoms bought it. The hell did two old folks need with all this space? Their father asked the realtor. The house was perfect, with bedrooms and bathrooms enough for everyone, and a yard with a tree perfect for a tire swing, and a kitchen in which more than one person can stand. And he, a car salesman with a nose so fine-tuned to bullshit that now he smelled it everywhere, began to feel cheated. You know, I once heard of this drug ring that buys houses where they can cook their filthy substances or store kidnapped victims, or, he leaned in to inspect a smudge on the wall, you know, murder someone in this bedroom, count their money in that bedroom. He looked to the realtor, a woman with the determination of someone on her third career, intense eye contact, smile as rigid and welcoming as a brick wall, moist eyes, waiting for her to confirm or deny, or at the very least, join him on his riff. Is that so? She asked. I hadn't heard about that. She looked at the mother, at the two little ones hugging her calves. She felt for the woman. She was herself just out of her second marriage, and it was occurring to her more and more that the problem was that she just didn't like the sound of a man's voice. Did they have to comment on everything? Her ex, Dan, used to stand outside the bathroom door and ask her when she'd be done. Seems to me it's your job to be up on those kinds of stories, Mr. Newsom said. And that was the other thing. Men like to smell blood in the water. They like to circle in so they could chomp, so they could kill you. Not kill you, but everything was win-lose, and losing meant they'd killed you. She could put on a slideshow of the times they, her exes, held something up in triumph. Mark with a cereal box proving the one she'd bought wasn't the same as the one he liked. Dan with her new bra shouting about the price. Mark with a sex magazine to prove what he wanted wasn't so offensive. Did men just walk around all day wondering why everyone was in their way? You'll have to send me the article, the realtor said, knowing there wasn't any such thing. She knelt down, her skirt stretching taut across her ass and making a worrisome stretching sound. I bet you boys can't wait to play out in that yard. They turned to look out the sliding glass doors, still clutching their mother in their fists, at the small patio beyond, the green patchy grass. In the far corner was a blue ball. The people who lived here before had a whole mess of grandkids, the realtor said. I bet that's their ball, left here special, just for you. She stood up. Why don't I take the children outside so you two can talk? She looked at Mrs. Newsom when she said this. She was there, but she wasn't. The same had happened to the realtor's sister after having kids. The realtor wanted Mrs. Newsom to make this decision. It was the right one. She needed a yard she could see from a variety of angles, out the kitchen window and out the family room window, so she could have some peace and quiet without losing sight of them. She imagined Mr. Newsom lifting weights in the garage, which was a generous way of putting it. She saw him sort of holding one up, getting distracted by his own thoughts, then pumping a few times for good measure, getting distracted again. Striding down his driveway to get the newspaper, hosting barbecues on that tidy patio. She watched them through the glass doors, Mr. Newsom pacing in a slow circle, and Mrs. Newsom half turned toward the yard, ever the worried mother. But the realtor saw her make a sharp motion with her hand, and when they came out, they agreed to buy the house. That's it.
I like anything with people watching other people because it's so scary.
Yeah. Plus, I love to do that myself.
Well, duh, yeah.
We drove through that neighborhood looking at lights with the kids, and it was so fun to look in everyone's windows and be like, oh, they're watching this, they're watching that, or they're running around.
God.
Nobody was running around. I don't know what I'm talking about. They're running around in a circle. Yeah, that's it. I think, you know, I'm just going to keep, one of my Peloton instructors talks about how the holidays are difficult. So you have to make sure you keep showing up to, you know, to exercise, to get in that cardio. And his recommendation was do it 3 times a week. 'Cause that's pretty doable. Three times, 30 minutes each time. And I feel the same way about writing. It's like this, like writing amid the chaos of being a parent is chaos within chaos. But if you promise yourself that you'll do it when you can, then it feels a little bit more in control.
Yeah.
And you can pretend it is.
Low bar. I think that's something that a lot of people really beat themselves up about.
Yeah.
Not getting strong sentences down or something that even makes sense to themselves, but that really doesn't matter. Nothing matters until it actually matters. And that's in the future. So don't worry.
Yeah. I mean, you guys heard, I just used the word stretching twice in the same sentence.
Yeah. Nobody noticed either. So, you know, like everybody was paying attention and nobody noticed.
So keep working. We have more episodes to come.
Thanks for listening.
Bye. I'm a Writer But is recorded by Alex Higley and me, Lindsay Hunter, in our respective basements. Because there's a pandemic out there, please wear a mask. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Editing by Lindsay Hunter. Music by Max Loop.